This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with author Charles Lane about his recent book, The Day Freedom Died, The Colfax Massacre, The Supreme Court, and The Betrayal of Reconstruction.
In this extraordinary book, Lane really tells us why what happened in the past is never in the past. What happened at Colfax allowed Jim Crow to flourish in the South for 100 years. Its legacy is still with us today.
We'll talk with one of the great pioneer lawyers, Ann Ginger, executive director of the Micklejohn Civil Liberties Institute and a longtime member of the National Lawyers Guild.
Ann has been on the front lines fighting for justice for over 60 years. Her belief that human rights are above property rights is one she still fights for.
Stay with us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
Last week, the Southern Poverty Law Center issued its investigative intelligence report. The cover story exposes a network of U.S. scholars paid by the Turkish government, many of whom are working actively to cover up the Turkish genocide of 1.5 million Armenians during World War I.
A consensus of genocide scholars agree that the slaughter of Armenians by Turkey's Ottoman government from 1915 to 1918 was a genocide.
It's worth noting that Gregory Stanton, who's the president of the International Association of Genocide Scholars, says that, quote, denial is the final state of genocide. It is a continuing attempt to destroy the victim group psychologically and culturally, to deny its members even the memory of the murders of their relatives. That is what the Turkish government today is doing to Armenians around the world.
Last year, the Elie Wiesel Foundation for Humanity issued a letter condemning Armenian genocidal denial. It was signed by 53 Nobel laureates, including Wiesel. And I should say to his credit, because to this date he has refused to denounce the treatment by the Zionist Israelis of the Palestinians. He's repeatedly called Turkey's 90-year-old campaign to cover up the Armenian genocide a double killing, since it strives to kill the memory of the original atrocities.
We've mentioned this before, but in 1943, law professor Raphael Lemkin, who later advised Nuremberg Chief Counsel Robert Jackson, actually coined the term genocide with the Armenians in mind.
Yes, I've always been particularly fond of Raphael Lemkin. First, he came from the same town or the same area where my father did in Poland, in Bialystok, and there's actually a monument to him. Sadly, though, even though he was a very important figure, worked on human rights issues and particularly on the genocide issue, he died penniless and in complete poverty in New York, really ignored by the wider community. But Raphael Lemkin is a name that people should really remember. He was one of the key human rights figures.
I found this interesting in the report. It says that in 1982, the government of Turkey gave $3 million to create the Institute for Turkish Studies, which is housed at Georgetown University. It's a nonprofit group. And it actively pushes a pro-Turkey agenda, including the denial of the genocide. The Institute receives sizable donations from American defense contractors that sell arms to Turkey, including General Dynamics and Westinghouse. And Turkey still provides an annual subsidy to the Institute, giving $85,000 in grants to scholars in 2006.
Yeah, American sleaze. Anyway, the report is available. Get out your pencils at SPL Center, SPLCenter.org.
Once again, we've seen that the rhetoric of the United States government about building peace and security has been directly contradicted by its actions. A couple of weeks ago, while more than 100 countries met in Dublin and signed a treaty banning the use of cluster bombs, the U.S., along with Russia, China, and Israel, refused to participate in the conference that led to the treaty and have also refused to sign it. You know, cluster bombs are particularly insidious munitions. They litter an area with hundreds of submunitions that are known as bomblets, which can both kill and maim individuals. And many of these bomblets don't explode on impact. They're similar to landmines because they can lurk undetected until civilians, and it's often children, can stumble on them or pick them up.
Yeah, they're brightly colored, actually, and people do go pick them up. And, of course, they've been used extensively. They were used extensively by Israel in the recent battle with Hezbollah in Lebanon.
It's the last thing Israel did.
Right,
they dropped them on the border.
Widely condemned. I don't remember the number. I mean, the number of bomblets
might have been a million.
Something
unbelievable.
Like that. And of course, it was widely used by the United States in Afghanistan and in Iraq. This is really a terrifying weapon. And once again, of course, it's the U.S. out there that refuses to sign the treaty or ratify it. But surprisingly, Britain signed it. The United Kingdom signed it, which was a big blow to the United States. Think about what's going to happen now. To the extent the U.S. ever has its coalitions of the willing that go into other countries, so-called coalitions of the willing, if you have a couple of countries in there who can't use these landmines, is that going to make it impossible for the U.S. to use the landmine? It may actually effectively do that. But, you know, you never trust the U.S. on these things. But this is a really ferocious weapon. Last week, the Center for Constitutional Rights also issued an important report on Guantanamo, and it concerned in particular the U.S. facilitation of visits by security personnel from countries that have a history of torture and abuse. So you had people coming to Guantanamo encouraged by the United States security forces to interview the Guantanamo detainees who were from places like Uzbekistan, Libya, Tunisia, Morocco, places that widely use torture. And of course, the U.S. not only made the Guantanamo detainees visit those people, but the U.S., of course, tortured them on the way to visit them. And oftentimes, those security forces would threaten the Guantanamo detainees with being taken back to their countries and tortured, or threaten what would happen to their families in their home country. So here you have the U.S. not only running this torture camp, but actually going around the world, getting countries that are widely engaged in torture, even according to the U.S.'s own human rights reports or State Department reports, and actually facilitating continued torture by those security personnel. It's a really shameful episode. And the important thing of the Center's report was it consolidated really a lot of the material that's come out over the last few years and just demonstrates that the practice was extremely widespread at Guantanamo. This wasn't just one or two people from a couple of countries. This was done as a matter of course from all over the world.
So the United States made available these people that they had captured for interrogators from other countries to come into Guantanamo and practice their art on these
people.
That's
exactly right, Michael. That's
how do we get a hold of that report?
You can go to the center's website, ccrjustice.org. Just look at Guantanamo, and you'll come up with both the press release, the report, and it was actually covered by one major news media, ABC News, actually covered this. But it's just another sordid chapter in our long history with Guantanamo.
It was April 13, 1873, in Louisiana when a small army of white ex-Confederate soldiers, enraged by freedmen asserting their new rights, killed more than 60 African Americans who had occupied a courthouse. Today we talk with author and journalist Charles Lane. His recent book is titled The Day Freedom Died: The Colfax Massacre, The Supreme Court, and the Betrayal of Reconstruction. In the book, Lane uncovers a nearly forgotten historic post-Civil War massacre of African-American men in Colfax, Louisiana, and a white lawyer's epic battle to bring the perpetrators to justice. Reviews call Lane's book an electrifying piece of historical detective work that captures a gallery of characters from presidents to townspeople and recreates the bloody days of Reconstruction. Lane discovered the Colfax massacre case while covering the Supreme Court for the Washington Post.
Welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much.
Charles, why don't you just give us a sort of overview of the book, and then we'll get into some of the harder questions.
The Day Freedom Died is all about an event that took place on April 13th, 1873, and its consequences. And that event was the massacre of over 60 black men in a village in Louisiana by white supremacists, most of whom were ex-Confederate soldiers. The federal government tried to prosecute the wrongdoers and achieve some modest success, but that was overturned by the Supreme Court, and this legal failure, this failure of the justice system, paved the way, in my view, for further racial violence in the South that went a long way toward reversing the gains of the Civil War.
The case that you're referring to, of course, you talk about in the book is United States versus Cruikshank, and it's the one that essentially said the federal government shouldn't have a role in prosecuting everything from lynchings to this massacre in the South, and that was a state matter. And that, of course, that legacy is still with us, although in the 60s we began to overcome some of the negativity of that case. But why don't you take us back to that period, because it's after the Civil War. A fact that I never knew, you wrote in the book, was that we had three majority black states in the South. I think Louisiana, Mississippi, and South Carolina. You had a legislature in Louisiana, I think, that was substantially black. Take us back to that period and put the massacre in maybe some context.
Yeah, you know, we tend to think of sort of Jim Crow just descending on the South shortly after the Civil War. But actually, there was an interim period, Reconstruction, in which in a number of states, black men, of course, women couldn't vote or hold office then, but black men had quite a bit of political power, mainly through the vote, but also in holding offices, including such high offices in Louisiana as lieutenant governor. And this led to tremendous conflict in the states that you mentioned and others, as essentially the old guard, the white supremacists of the state, resisted this truly revolutionary change. And the incident that I write about in this book grew out of the 1872 election, which was disputed in Louisiana, and in every single county of Louisiana. They were known as parishes, of course. And in this one little town, Colfax, which was the headquarters, the capital of Grant Parish, black men with weapons, although very poor weapons, tried to defend the courthouse where their chosen office holders were in place, and they were attacked by a group of men over 150 strong with very heavy weapons, including artillery, and were subdued. And really, the federal government faced a choice at that time, whether to intervene militarily in the South and, in effect, fight a second civil war, this time against kind of recalcitrant white terrorists, or to attempt to deal with this through a sort of a middle approach, law enforcement. They chose that middle approach, and when it failed, that was pretty much the end of it.
When you say it failed, it sort of gave a license, really, to white supremacists, not only in Louisiana, but throughout the South, to really put blacks, into what some people have called a neo-slavery, but certainly Jim Crow.
Yes, the crucial point here was to suppress black voting, because that was the right upon which all other rights depended. And as you mentioned, there were three states, South Carolina, Mississippi, and Louisiana, where blacks were in the majority. And that frightened the white population of these states tremendously and made them feel that their only hope, of course, they ruled out from the beginning any compromise, any approach to black voters, any attempt to appeal to their interests. They wanted to suppress black voting, and the way they thought of doing it was through violence and terror. It's interesting that this terrorism was done sort of in the pursuit of winning elections, but it was very effective because in the late 1870s, despite the continuing majority of black of eligible voters being black, these states all went to what was then the party of white supremacy, the Democratic Party.
When I read your book, from the first page, if you're a black person living in Louisiana, you have to just be terrified for your life every second. I mean, that's what I got out of it.
Well, what's remarkable about this period, in a way, is how many people didn't submit to the fear, both white and black, I might add. There were a number of white Republicans at that time who risked their lives for a different kind of a future for the South. But, you know, it was a very raw and violent time generally. We were fresh out of a war. The country was very chaotic and disorganized. Every man had a hunting weapon. A number of people did try to resist this, but you're right. for the most part, the intimidation was very effective, and over the long term, because of the lack of effective federal intervention, it achieved its purpose.
Charles, you write so beautifully and dramatically. Two characters, I think, that you really bring to life are, of course, the central hero of the book, James Beckwith, and then somebody that really intrigues me, William Ward, and I'll tell you why later. But in any case, I wanted you to share with our audience your appreciation for these two figures, one black, one white.
James R. Beckwith was a northern-born man who came to New Orleans, Louisiana before the war, and after the war, as a Republican, was the U.S. attorney in New Orleans, which at that time was the capital of the state. Probably because of his religious commitment to abolition or anti-slavery before the war, felt very strongly about this crime and dedicated himself to seeing justice done. And despite a lot of death threats and other obstacles, he saw the case through two long jury trials in the heat of New Orleans. He sought the death penalty for the white perpetrators, which would have been an absolutely revolutionary development in the South for white men to be executed for killing black men. He wouldn't achieve that in the end, but the mere fact that he could conceive of it marked him, in my view, as truly committed to the cause. And then there's the intriguing character of William Ward, who was a state representative, a black man who escaped from slavery in Virginia, went into service in the Union Army, and through a long series of accidents, found his way to Colfax on this day at the head of this, I guess you could say, kind of ragtag black force that was attempting to defend the courthouse. And Ward, I guess the sort of highlight in his action in this event, as they were becoming surrounded by whites, he sent out a kind of a pathetic plea to a black minister on a neighboring plantation, a letter calling on this man to send reinforcements to defend what Ward called our rights and our children's rights. But in the end, that letter came to naught. There were no reinforcements, and no help came, and the massacre took place.
So we're speaking with Charles Lane, Washington Post reporter who actually covers the Supreme Court, on his amazing book called The Day Freedom Died, The Colfax Massacre, The Supreme Court, and the Betrayal of Reconstruction.
I'm interested in how you first became involved or learned about the Colfax Massacre.
Well, I read a short, I would say, travelogue in a magazine about it. Someone had gone down to Colfax and had discovered that there's a monument, actually two, in the town, left over from the earlier part, well, from the 20th century, early part of the 20th century, which in effect memorialized the white victims of what is called the Colfax Riot. And sort of shocked by that.
These were, just to interrupt for a second, when I read the amazing review that you were given in the New York Times, I think they began with the quote from the monument in the cemetery, the obelisk.
You read it, Michael.
And I'd just like to read it. What it is, an obelisk in the cemetery, and you can describe it better. I've never seen it. You have, although I would like to visit it at some point. But what it says, in loving remembrance, erected to the memory of the heroes, and then it mentions the three names of white men who fell in the Colfax riot fighting for white supremacy, April 13th, 1873. Right. And that's sitting there in the cemetery right now. You actually visited that monument, I gather.
Right, it's still there. Well, the men were gathered in a courthouse, surrounded by the white troops, who then torched the courthouse so that the black men were, you know, about to be burned alive. And so they ran out, surrendering, but they were shot as they were surrendering. So some of them went back into the courthouse where they were burned alive. Others were shot as they fled, and the rest, about three dozen, I think, were captured. And then later that night, those men were taken out in pairs and shot in the back of the head. So it was a very cold-blooded kind of a massacre. No one was killed on the black side except one or two during any kind of actual combat. The vast majority of them were killed either when they had laid down their arms and were trying to surrender, or after they had been taken prisoner. And they were buried a few days later in a mass grave, which has never been marked. There's no monument over that.
I know a couple of those people who were supposedly executed by the whites actually crawled out and escaped alive.
Yes.
They eventually testified, I think, at the trial. Is that right?
Yes, and you talk about heroes in the book. I really consider a lot of the freedmen and freedwomen who testified as real heroes. Some of them had survived, as you say, the wounds that they received that night in the dark. Others were the wives of those who'd been killed but had witnessed some of the killing. And it took tremendous courage for them to go into federal court and testify and literally point fingers at white men and say, they killed, they committed murder. A number of witnesses were killed, actually, for doing that. But nevertheless, these people were so bent on justice that they went to court and made their statements.
Now, there is a historical marker at the site of the courthouse, which, again, you have a picture of it in your book. And it says Colfax Riot, which is, of course, the name that I guess the Democrats or the anti-Reconstruction people use for it. And it says, on this site occurred the Colfax Riot, in which three white men and 150 Negroes were slain. This event on April 13, 1873, marked the end of carpetbagging misrule in the South. Now, I know there's some factual error in it on the 150,
yes.
But when was a sign like that or a historical marker like that put up?
It was erected in 1951 at the suggestion, essentially, of local white people in Grant Parish, but with the money of the state of Louisiana. And what I say in my book is that that, in effect, put the state's imprimatur on this distorted and falsified version of events. One of the really troubling aspects to me of this whole story, of course, it's a terrible thing that it happened in the first place, but then the systematic lying and distortion about the real facts and how that worked its way into the history books of Louisiana and, indeed, the history books of the whole country for so many decades. It took a lot of work, 4 years of research, to peel back all those layers and get down to what I think is the truth.
Yeah, it's an amazing book. Again, for our listeners, we're speaking with Charles Lane, Washington Post Supreme Court reporter, who wrote a really crucial book, important, The Day Freedom Died, The Colfax Massacre, The Supreme Court, and the Betrayal of Reconstruction. Now, Charles, I'd like to get into the law part of it because
yes.
Partly we're a law program, but partly your book is very concerned by what happened in the Supreme Court with the case that went up to it, you know, with the indictments of the convictions of some of the people involved in the Colfax Massacre, some of the whites. You know, give us some historical context. There were some amendments passed after the Civil War, then there was the Enforcement Act, and sort of bring us up to date on that.
Well, the real question, to try and summarize it, was who would have authority to protect the rights of all these new citizens who'd been created as citizens by the 14th Amendment? And it wasn't an easy question for the Americans of the time because there was a long-held tradition that all law enforcement was a state matter. But what we had in the South were states that were either extremely weak or actively complicit in some cases with this kind of mass violence against black people. And so then the question became, well, could the federal government use its authority to protect these rights under the new amendments to the Constitution, to protect people really in their lives? And Congress of that time said, yes, it can, and it passed these statutes which made it a federal crime to violate the civil rights, I'm summarizing, of any American citizen. And the efforts to enforce this started with the crackdown on the Ku Klux Klan in 1871 and 1872, which was fairly successful and employed the assistance of the military to make arrests. But by the time the Colfax Massacre took place in 1873, political support in the North for this kind of law enforcement was waning. A lot of people in the North were not convinced that it was really constitutional. Some of them objected based on the cost. And, of course, underneath it all was a certain sense of racism that suggested that, well, black people haven't really proved themselves worthy of their freedom anyway, so really who cares about them? And the Colfax Massacre and the Supreme Court case that results from it becomes what I regard as a real turning point, because as a result of the Circuit Justice Joseph Bradley throwing out the convictions in 1874, it essentially created a complete legal vacuum in the South between 1874 and 1876, during which the Klan and organizations like it really just went wild in both Louisiana and Mississippi, and then later on in South Carolina.
And then bringing it up to date, it took close to 100 years before the Supreme Court revisited this issue. There was a case I remember from law school, U.S. v. Guest, I think. And then there was a enforcement, Civil Rights Act, I think Section 245 of the Code, that then allowed some of this conduct to be prosecuted.
Yes, but what's interesting is that because of decisions like Cruikshank, which was just part of a broader movement at the court in the 1870s and 1880s, the court was limited in the interpretations it could give of the 14th Amendment and other constitutional texts that would actually support the federal interventions in the South that took place in the 60s. And it created a number of legal obstacles and hurdles to federal authority right through the 50s and 60s. And even today, I think the very narrow and pinched interpretation of the federal authority under the 14th Amendment that was created by the court in the 1870s still weighs on the legal system and still influences the legal doctrine today. Obviously not to the extent it did in the past, but to a real extent.
I remember, you know, when I began work at the Center for Constitutional Rights, we had, of course, a bunch of lawyers in the South, Arthur Canoy and others. And what they did, they prosecuted all from King to everybody else in the state courts for demonstrations. Well, it's a little different. What they did is they formulated a removal. There was a removal statute, and they were able to remove all of those state court cases against blacks into federal court where they could get fair trials or get dismissed. So it's sort of still a legacy of that same kind of history of really state courts, certainly in the 50s and 60s in the South, being not ones where a black man could get a fair trial. What was it like being in Louisiana doing the research? I mean, what was the reaction of people, whether at the libraries or in the local bars or whatever, to your digging into the Colfax massacre?
I had all different reactions. I had some people say, wow, I never heard of that. Write me back when you finish. I'd like to know what you found out. I had some people say, oh, you don't want to get into that. Let's just let sleeping dogs lie. But for the most part, and this holds true for both black and white people in Grant Parish who I met, they were just intensely curious and I think pleased that somebody was systematically going through this history. Grant Parish is very lightly populated. It is very poor. It's one of the poorest counties in America. People there don't have a lot of resources to do this kind of research themselves. And I got a lot of support, actually, from local folks who, you know, had this or that to contribute. When I went down to Grant Parish after the book was published and I gave a speech, this was back in March, I gave a talk, you know, telling people about the book and signing a few books, I got a terrific reception. It was actually a very beautiful event. About 50 people turned out in the elementary school gym there, people of both races. I think there really are still only two races in that county. And they were very welcoming and curious and receptive. And I think what I'm hoping here is that this book will lead to some effort in Louisiana to acknowledge publicly what happened in those years and to erect the appropriate monuments. I'm not sure I think we should tear down old ones because they're now of historical interest, but maybe erect an appropriate monument to the victims of this. And I think there is some move afoot at the local and state level there to make that happen.
I have one last question that was intriguing in the book, and one I had never seen discussed, is the Hayes-Tilden election.
Yes.
You know, essentially, I don't know if our listeners know, but it was essentially a tie vote, and a tie vote in the House. Is that right?
Yes.
185 to 185, as I recall.
In the Electoral College.
In the Electoral College, not in the House, right. And then there was a deal made, and the deal was also something that, in my view of reading your book, really contributed to having a South that would continue to suppress black rights. And what can you just describe what that deal was?
Basically, there was an impasse in the election, not very different from the one we had in 2000. And the Republican Rutherford B. Hayes was essentially induced to compromise with the Democrats. He would get the White House, and the Republicans would retain control of the executive branch. In return for which, the federal troops that were guarding Republican claimants to the state governments of Louisiana and South Carolina, those federal troops would be withdrawn, which meant, because there were these huge white militias waiting to take over, that the whites would stage what were in effect coup d'etat and become the state government. And that compromise, as it developed through the succeeding years, essentially boiled down to the federal government ceding control of civil rights enforcement to the states of the South and political control to the white supremacists. So white supremacists didn't have much interest in enforcing civil rights. And that was the kind of pact that the country lived under, you know, right up to the time of World War II and Brown versus Board of Education.
And we still actually, I mean, even after that, paid a high price for compromises we had to make with the sort of Democratic office holders in the South from then on, who were, you know, insisted on segregation, et cetera, from Baubus up, because of this deal that was made way before that gave them that kind of control.
It was essentially an effort to preserve the Union at the expense of its black citizens. And in that way, not too much different from the pre-Civil War compromises, such as the Compromise of 1850. And in a way, it showed there was a kind of an arc the country had traveled, really, from that failed Compromise of 1850 through the Civil War, in which pro or anti-slavery sentiment in the North reached its peak and resulted in the Emancipation Proclamation and the 13th Amendment. And then that kind of progress sort of dwindled until you get back to 1877. And the white men who made the decisions in those days, concluding that the best way to hold the country together would be to kind of deal black citizens out settle things that way.
Well, Charles, I want to really thank you. I want to tell our listeners again, we're talking to Charles Lane, author of an utterly extraordinary book. I think I read it in a day and a half. I just couldn't put it down. It's called The Day Freedom Died, The Colfax Massacre, The Supreme Court, and The Betrayal of Reconstruction. Thank you again, Charles, for being on our show, but even more for writing a really significant book.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Thanks.
So long.
Bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org. Today, we're delighted to have pioneer lawyer and human rights activist Ann Ginger on Law and Disorder. Ann is the founder and executive director of the Mikkeljohn Civil Liberties Institute, a think tank for human rights in Berkeley, California. We've examined the practices and laws that have crippled civil liberties and human rights in this country, and now we'll take a look at the ways law students and legal workers can help bring them back. Ann Ginger has published four little orange books. The first, titled Landmark Cases Left Out of Your Textbooks. The second is The Living Constitution. The third, Undoing the Bush-Cheney Legacy. And the fourth, Making the Universal Declaration the Supreme Law of the Land. Anne writes that the roles of successful lawyers and legal workers in the future will not be the same as the roles of successful lawyers before the Bush-Cheney's so-called War on Terrorism. Anne, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Ann, I'm so happy to have you on the show. I was recalling to Michael and Heidi when I first met you. You invited me over for dinner. I was way back. I was a clerk out in Oakland in 1965, and I was friends with Joni Rabinowitz.
Uh-huh.
You had been friends with her lawyer. Her father was the great lawyer, Victor Rabinowitz. And Joni was organizing farm workers in the Salinas Valley that year. You probably remember.
Yes.
And she was coming over, and she invited me to tag along. And I had finished 1 year of law school, and you were the first radical lawyer I ever met. You made a big impression on me. You took me out in the backyard to the garage where the Alexander Micheljohn library.
No, it's not a garage. People always call it a garage. We have a garage. This is a separate building. It's not a garage, and I'm sitting in it right now.
Well, whatever it was, it impressed me that you were that organized and that together and dedicated to do that. I went back to the University of Wisconsin to law school, and I considered myself a guild member and have from that point on. So I was always grateful to meet you so many years ago.
Well, I think that the reason I say it's not a garage and that it's important is that we've been around for 40 years. We started it in 1965, actually 1964, and we have now had 400 interns working here. And someone came yesterday from the University of North Carolina Law School to start working this summer on the Toolkit for Congress book that we're going to be doing.
Toolkit book is what you're calling undoing the Bush-Cheney legacy, right?
That's right.
What in the Bush-Cheney legacy, I remember Gore Vidal calling it the Bush-Cheney oil gas junta, what in the legacy do you think we should take special aim at?
Well, I think that one of the problems with the progressive movement today is that there are so many things to take special aim at that we're not. So this is going to be a toolkit for Congress, and it takes up everything. We're going to have 100 pages, and we're going to have the habeas corpus denial or getting rid of habeas corpus. We're going to have suggesting getting rid of ICE altogether. It's unconscionable to have one agency that deals with human beings, immigrants, and also deals with products in customs, so that's absurd.
That's ICE, right?
ICE, right, sometimes called BICE. And we're going to talk about getting rid of the Military Commissions Act and the Patriot Act, all of these various statutes passed by Congress, sometimes with the suggestion of the president, sometimes without, but they all need to be gotten rid of. And we're also going to try to list all of the worst executive orders and signing statements and saying that Congress should repudiate them. So this is meant to be a handbook for the members of Congress, House and Senate, to use as best they can, and we should get it into their faces and urge them to pass all of these laws, that is to repeal all of the bad statutes from the Bush years and some from even before that.
You're talking about aiming it at Congress, but you mentioned executive orders. Now, isn't that something that a president, the day he takes office, can just basically eliminate all those bad executive orders?
That's true, but this is aimed at Congress. And so Congress could make a resolution. We urge the president to abolish executive orders such and such and such and such.
Gotcha.
This is aimed at the Congress. I think that we have a greater chance of convincing some Congress members to act than we have directly to convince the president in the first. And we're going to propose that they start January, 3rd, to start doing this.
Now, that's an interesting perspective because, I've been thinking about it, whether the best goal is to try and get the president to repudiate a bunch of executive orders when he gets into office or whether you go to Congress. And you're saying you're thinking the congressional route is much more productive.
Well, I'm in favor of everybody doing everything.
Right.
If people know the president or know a way to talk to the president or get to his staff, I think that's fine. But I think that we all know Congress members. They represent us, allegedly. And they could make a resolution or a statement saying we urge the president to wipe out this number of executive orders and also the signing statements. So this toolkit can be used in any way anybody wants to use it. But we're specifically proposing it for members of Congress.
Are you saying that signing statements can be wiped out?
Well, if a statute is repealed or abolished, the signing statement is obviously also abolished.
Right.
And there's great question about whether a signing statement is legal or illegal. And in the UN system, and I want to get into that in a minute, they've said specifically that you can't sign a treaty and ratify the treaty and then say you're not going to do it. And that's what the U.S. has been doing. They've been ratifying three human rights treaties and then saying we don't mean what it says in a certain section.
through the signing statements.
Yes,
right.
And the UN has said explicitly that this is not the law, and of course it is not international law.
And I wanted just to take a step back to let listeners know that this new book that's coming out is actually part of a series that you've published. We are calling them the Four Little Orange Books.
Yes, I don't know whether any of you ever heard of the Haldeman Julius Little Blue Books, but when I was young, which was a long time ago, there were little blue books, and they would have a speech that Clarence Darrow made to a jury, or a speech that Eugene Debs made. They were the Little Blue Book series, and now we're making the Little Orange Book series.
Orange because of Guantanamo?
I don't. Just because it's a bright color, I think.
Tell us the titles of the books in the series and how people can get a hold of them.
All right. The first one is called Landmark Cases Left Out of Your Textbooks. And the second one is called The Living Constitution. And the third is going to be called Undoing the Bush-Cheney Legacy Toolkit for Congress. And the fourth one is going to be called Making the Universal Declaration of Human Rights the Supreme Law of the Land. So each of them is about 100 pages, and you can hold them easily in your hand, 8.5 by 5.5. The first one, Landmark Cases, came about because, as I said, Micheljohn has had 400 interns over the years, and I would ask students as they came in, and it turned out they had never heard of the Dolores Huerta case. They had never heard, frankly, of Huey Newton or the Black Panther case. They'd certainly never heard of Big Bill Haywood. And all these are important trials that were won in trial. It's important to know, for a law student, to know that you can win before a jury. And it hadn't occurred to me that in law school you study written opinions. So if there's a jury verdict in favor of our side, it's not going to be in the law book. And it's critical that young lawyers and law students and people concerned, activists, know that we sometimes win in trial.
I think that's a great point. I mean, really, a lot of the major political struggles in this country took place in trial courts. I think, Anne, that's really something that I think all of us sitting here never really thought about.
So how do we get a hold of these books?
You go on the web to www.mcli.org, and it stands for Micheljohn Civil Liberties Institute, www.mcli.org.
I'd like to add that book, the first one, Landmark Cases, is it's a remarkable publication. Every law student and lawyer should own it.
Yes, and I wish a few law professors would realize that they have a responsibility, and poli-sci professors in college. The students have a right to learn that there was a period in the 1930s when working people organized into unions, and they won. It shows in this book. And what's even more important, and we try to emphasize this all the time, I grew up in East Lansing, Michigan, and that was an auto city. Lansing was an auto city. And in 1932 and 33, there were a whole bunch of white male auto workers who hated black people and hated unions, and they were Republicans. And after they lost their jobs, maybe I should have said a couple years before that, something happened to them. And some of them joined the Black Legion, which was a northern Ku Klux Klan kind of organization, and they killed people. But many, many, many more white male Republican voters learned there was such a thing as a union. They learned that they'd been fired or put out of their jobs because of the Depression, and they wanted to do something about it. And these people became Democrats, they became union leaders, and they became aware that you work with African Americans. They changed totally. And it happened. I mean, I saw it happen to people. And so I think it's important for young people today to know that it can happen. It has to happen again. And I think it can happen. And then one way is to know the history.
And through the National Lawyers Guild, I know that you are a great mentor to the law students who work for you every summer. In addition to impressing on them the importance of knowing history, do you have any other words of advice for people who want to be what we call people's lawyers?
I do indeed, and you may or may not like this, and I say this as somebody who's very proud that I argued and won a case in the United States Supreme Court in 1959, and it only took me 8 years to win against the Ohio and American Activities Commission. But I would say to the young people today that we're not going to win cases in the U.S. Supreme Court for the next 30 years, by and large, because of the composition of the court and the age of the reactionary justices now on the court. And if that is true, then we have to rethink how many class action lawsuits we should file and whether there are other paths for action. And what we are saying is that there are two new paths for action that work. I'm not saying that they are automatic or that they immediately bring about the result you want. But one of those is filing a complaint with the Office of Inspector General. I didn't even know there was an Office of Inspector General until a few years ago. But if you've read the papers lately, this past week, the Office of Inspector General, there's one for every single federal agency. And in New York City, there's a OIG for any U.S. government office in New York City. They're not all in Washington. And they have to make a report every 6 months to John Conyers, or that's how I put it. The OIGs must make a report every 6 months to the chair and the vice chair of the House and Senate Judiciary Committees. And these reports describe any complaints that have come up about the action of a particular government agency. As you may have heard or read, the OIG of the FBI said that the FBI had complained about what the Department of Defense and others were doing in Guantanamo. And that's within the government. They said it's illegal what you're doing here. And so I believe that it would be important and will be important for lawyers and law students and legal workers and activists to start making complaints to the Office of Inspector General of the particular agency that they're involved in and to follow through. And one of the problems is that the departments don't always contact you after you file a complaint. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. But they do deal with it.
And how do you actually file the complaint? You write something up and submit it to the OIG?
Well, there's no formal way. Maybe there will be if enough of us do it, but that's what you do. Yes, you give you who you are and why you are doing it. Give the facts very, very clearly. It also helps if you give it to the media at the same time. And some of the people in the Office of Inspector General are not Bush Republicans. I mean, they're civil servants, and they believe in doing what they're supposed to do.
And what was, I'm sorry, what was the other avenue that you suggest for militants?
Yes, this is a little longer, and I think it is equally effective. And before I start saying it, I want to be clear that when you win a case like Brown against Board of Education in 1954, it does not mean that that Supreme Court opinion is automatically enforced. It took a long time to integrate the schools, even in Berkeley, California. So what I'm proposing is a long-range approach, which I think works, but it doesn't automatically get you a huge victory. So what it's called is that the U.S. has ratified 3 human rights reporting treaties. And as you know, under the Constitution, a treaty is the supreme law of the land. It says that right in the Constitution. And it specifically says in the Constitution that state as well as federal judges must enforce these treaties. So the U.S. has ratified the U.N. Charter, as you know, in 1945. In addition, though, the U.S. has ratified in 1992 the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. And in 1994, the Senate ratified the Convention on Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination. And in 1994, the Senate ratified the Convention Against Torture and Other Cruel, Inhuman, or Degrading Treatment or Punishment. I know that's a lot to absorb in a minute. But the first one we call ICCPR, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. And we call the Torture Convention CAT, and we call the Race Discrimination Convention CERD, C-E-R-D.
So it's the 3 treaties.
And each of these treaties requires the U.S. government to file a report with the U.N. committee that administers the treaty periodically. So every 2 years to the Race Discrimination Committee, every 4 years to the Torture Committee, and every 5 years to the committee that enforces the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. And the second and all future reports must include information at the local level. Well, the U.S. government, of course, hasn't been doing this. They've filed very few of the reports required, and they have never had the Attorney General of the U.S. tell every state attorney general that they must file a report. But the reality we have found in Berkeley is that if you cause a city government to file a report with a U.N. committee, it affects the behavior of the civil servants in the city. And they realize that what they do in Berkeley, California, is going to be reported in Geneva, Switzerland. And so I'm urging people to do what I did. I convinced the Berkeley Commission on Peace and Justice to convince the City Council of Berkeley to become the first in the United States to make reports to the 3 committees. And we carefully send a copy to the Attorney General of California, who doesn't seem to know what to do with it because he's never been told to make a report by the federal government in any orderly way. That is to say, apparently the Attorney General of the U.S. at a speech to the Attorney General's Conference of State Attorneys General told them something about this, but that was all. But we send the report to the Attorney General of the state, we send it to the U.S. Department of State, and then we send it directly to the committees in Geneva, and Mikeljohn Institute has sent somebody to Geneva to the meetings of the committees where they raise the issue with the committee members.
So they got to testify on the report.
Well, it isn't exactly testifying. The committees welcome what they call shadow reports from people like us, but they don't exactly testify. You meet informally with the committee members, but I tell you, they pick it right up. I don't know.
Because no one's doing it, except for you.
Now the U.S. Human Rights Network is beginning to do this as a large organization of younger activists in many organizations around the country, and they have been doing it more recently. Nobody has done what we've done, is to get a city to do it.
Mm.
But, for example, Judge Claudia Morcom, whom you know from Detroit.
I used to work for her.
Good. She was a courageous African-American woman who headed up the Lawyers Guild Committee to Assist Southern Lawyers in the 1960s, and she became a judge. She's now retired, so she's retired into being active with Mikeljohn Civil Liberties Institute. And she went to Geneva. And, for example, in its report to the Committee on Elimination of Racial Discrimination recently, a couple of years ago, the U.S. just didn't even mention Katrina. And so Claudia mentioned Katrina in a meeting before informally with the committee members, and as a result, the issue of Katrina came up. And by the second day, the U.S. government was falling all over itself, saying, we're going to, haven't you heard, we're sending more money to Louisiana. Oh, haven't you heard, we're going to investigate what happened on that bridge.
You know, that typical story of what a troublemaker you are, Ann.
But, Ann, no, what you're talking about, I think, is really an essential grassroots movement that could take place in this country if concerned groups and people in different states did this.
Absolutely. Well,
can we see the shadow report?
Sure, you can go to our webpage, which is www.mcli.org.
And we could put a link to that on our Law and Disorder website, because I think if people actually see what the shadow report looks like, it will resonate with them. For example, if a lawyer has witnessed police brutality or torture in a certain circumstance, that's the kind of thing we would report on.
Absolutely. And then you can, the same report can be used in a report to one of these three committees. It can also be used in the work that we're doing on the book for the Undoing the Bush Legacy. And it can be used in filing an OIG complaint, you see? In other words, we're trying to help lawyers in this period learn that the only place to go is not to court. And you should know, in the 30s, Lawyers Guild members didn't spend a lot of time going to court. They became activists in government agencies, in the National Labor Relations Board, in the new Social Security agencies, and so forth, and in state agencies, so that it wasn't all going to court. That wasn't the concept. And I think it's important to have that idea in mind. And you call me a troublemaker, and I was going to say, I tell people, they always say you've been a law professor, and that's true, and I've run Mikeljohn Civil Liberties Institute, and so forth and so on, but I really am from an English Quaker, Irish Catholic, Lithuanian Jewish, Midwestern socialist journalist family, and that's why I do what I do.
Well, you do it extremely well. It's just an honor to have you on Law and Disorder, Ann.
And you're a fabulous activist and attorney, and really a mentor to hundreds and hundreds of law students and other attorneys in the National Lawyers Guild and elsewhere.
You know, and part of what we do here is lawyers you'll like. And I have a question for you. When did you become a lawyer and why?
Well, I wanted to be a writer, and I decided when I was in high school, we had a career course in the 10th grade, and you were supposed to decide what you were going to do, and I decided I couldn't make a living as a writer, so I would become a lawyer. So I graduated from high school at 16. I went to and worked my way through the University of Michigan Law School between 1941 and 1947, graduated in 47, and I was going to become a labor lawyer. So I applied, excuse the expression, to a number of National Lawyers Guild people, because I had started the first student chapter at the University of Michigan while I was a student there. And so I wrote to these people, whose names I guess I shouldn't give, the best-known labor law firm in Detroit. And, of course, I wrote a letter, and the man who was the head of the firm knew my parents from the old Intercollegiate Socialist Society in 1912. And he said, so I wrote a second letter. I wrote seven letters to that firm trying to get a job. And finally, they didn't know exactly what to do with me. I mean, I was a woman, after all. And so they said, you can come into the firm and you can work for the National Lawyers Guild collecting dues from delinquent members. Yeah. Could not hire me as a lawyer.
A bill collector.
That continued, I should say, for quite some years. And the fact is that the male lawyers in the Lawyers Guild may have treated Carol King ultimately with some respect because she was winning cases in the U.S. Supreme Court, but they never treated her as an equal. Mm. And I was younger, and who was I? And besides, I knew shorthand and could type, so why didn't I, you know? Anyway, so I practiced law in Michigan for 6 months. Then I moved to Ohio and worked briefly for a law firm before the McCarthy period caused the firm to be unretained by the union that they had been representing, so that I was in Ohio without any job. And I moved to Boston for 2 years, and then I moved to New York for 5 years, and then I moved to California. But in all of that period, male lawyers were not prepared to hire me to be a lawyer, and that is no longer true. But I would also say to young women lawyers that I married and had a couple of kids and took care of my kids. I worked half-time in the law and half-time raising my kids, and I think that women have a right to be lawyers and successful and act like women, which is different than acting like men.
Good point, Anne.
Well, if anyone wants to help us with the toolkit book, they should go on the web at legacy@mcli.org. The goal is to get the book out in time for the Lawyers Guild Convention in October and to hand to Congress members the minute they're elected in November.
All beautiful. Right. Just a beautiful project.
All right.
Take it easy.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
That's lawanddisorder.org.